2020 and David Thurman was sixth. Members present are Representative Tallarico, Representative Cott, Representative Lincoln, Representative Benjamin Benestrio, Representative Montez, and myself. Representative Philip, the chair. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. May I ask the board to silence yourselves for the duration of the meeting? Before we begin, as always, I'd like to thank Jamie Perry, the chairman of the Secretary for Records, and Bill Prentice, certainly to all of us for serving the committee today. We have nothing on the agenda, so we will turn our attention to a presentation by Representative Quatman and start by 2 and House Bill 287 relating to the Village Public Safety Officer Program. I'd also like to note that Mike Nias, the Public Safety Coordinator for the Ocean Public Health Association, is on his phone to answer questions as they arise. Representative Quatman, Mr. Truitt, if you could go to the testifier table, introduce yourself for the record, and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Chuck Todd, Representative for District 24. I have with me my team member, Ken Kirk. Thank you, Madam Chair, and committee, Ken Kirk, staff, Representative Todd. Madam Chair, it is our delight to present the work that's been long in progress since May of this past year. Just to kind of take the committee back just a little bit, this work is a product of the Village Public Safety Officer Work Group that was created by Speaker Hedgman. I chaired this committee at a Senate presentation in December 29th in response to the recruitment and retention process for Village Public Safety Officers. Nevertheless, structural challenges the program faced to supports that the program was in need of retaining officers who actually worked in the program and then the ability to recruit them. And it was shortly after that that the U.S. Attorney General of the received his public safety crisis declaration for rural Afghan. Some special sessions last year, so the work group really never got after until August. So between August and December, there was quite a bit of work done. And this work group report was adopted January 24th of this year by a committee. And it was adopted unanimously. Those committee members were on the Senate side, my co-chair, Senator Don Nelson, Senator Rick Schauer, and Senator the representatives, of course, Speaker Edgman, Representative Richard Marshall, and myself. So, good, diverse work group representing vast areas of the state. And it was really a privilege to get out into Alaska. We had several community meetings that ranged from Bethel and in fact, Representative Lincoln was very instrumental in hosting us up north with our borough for a community listening session on rural public safety issues and the BPSO program in particular. And we also were joined to that meeting by U.S. Attorney General Brian Schroeder, who was there, and also his office was represented there, and of course, he was with us in Bethel. We also were able to have listening sessions at the FN at the time of Chief's conference, the Tribal Unity Caucus, and a couple others. We also met directly with the Department of Public Safety leadership team at the very beginning. Ms. Kelly Howell from BPS attended most or was online for most of the presentations and participation from BPS through the process. You know, we'd say that at the beginning, BPS made very clear was that the vision for the program needed to be laid out by the legislature. If we wanted to be different, we would need to change the law. And that's what we've done in response to what the community has said. So that's just a high level overview. Madam Chair, the BPS Conservation Program was created in the 70s for the protection of life and property. It has certain roles to a primary public safety role, literally here repeatedly in communities around the state. The program currently has 10 entities which operate VPSO grants. 8 of the 10 entities are New Zealand-based nonprofit corporations whose missions are to cultivate self-determination among their tribal citizens as they deliver public safety services to one of the federally recognized tribe and there are 5-starred borough of the Home Rule Regional Government seated in Fontainebleau as the only grantee organization that is also a municipal government. While the VPSO program has provided valuable service to participating areas, has continued to see shrinking numbers of VPSOs and a significant difficulty in recruiting and retaining these individuals. So, in response to this, we have these recommendations. The bill intervention that kind of highlighted the creation of the proper group activities that were in the borrowers as well. So, that it is well for the community, actually. And full work group activities, there you have the time here in front of you. Just a quick time, that's not too much of a timeline. If you start in August and you just go left or right, you can see just a proper rehash of what I just said. The co-chairs, myself and Senator Olson, we had several meetings that were very instructive to us as we proceeded on this journey. The meeting with the AFN Canada Council for National Alaska Natives Treaty Convention to plan the public safety panel, and I believe myself, Speaker, and President Diesel, and Louis Attorney, Brian Schroeder, Senator Brian Olson. We're all part of that panel, and we heard directly from a large group of people that's through throughout the state of how the VPSO program has impacted their communities. Of course, the Commissioner of Public Safety also participated on that panel. The U.S. Department of Interior, Borough and Affairs, Rural Public Safety Listening Session, that was a tremendous experience that really got into partnerships with VPSO before our corporation was there, and other entities that had VPSO partnerships in Northwest Alaska. And then finally, they were invited to meet with the grantee organizations, leadership, and VPSO management personnel in Anchorage, hosted by the English and Girls Association, and went through these recommendations with them. So, long term, respect looking out over the horizon. What's the vision for this group? To continue working with our federal partners on training. And some of that begins with formal state tribal recognition. And this is really key matter to our tribes are able to access federal law enforcement training dollars in programs. The U.S. Department of Interior was represented along with White House and Special Counsel. And that was attached to this, and also two other federal agencies that said that the best federal law enforcement training center and the Indian Law Enforcement Academy together train over 10,000 tribal police officers in the United States. And they said anytime Alaska invites them up, they have training funds available to partner with them. The organizations and tribal programs to provide top-flight public safety instruction, regional hubs, and other training that you can get. They just need to be invited, and they need to feel that they're doing it with the blessing of the state to help, but they're not going to insert themselves unless they're invited. So that was exciting to hear, and they're very much looking forward to helping us raise the input that they need to. I would emphasize that these are training dollars that normally the only option would be the Department of Public Safety provide that training to them, said, and they are an agency who trains very well, but also they train a lot. They train municipal, they train state, they train same place, even more opportunities for training our village public safety officers with Baltimore. So, I don't know if this is there, but I'm not doing any state or states have recurrent criminal jurisdiction with crimes, unlike other non-public law doing states. And the BIA historically has not requested federal law or law enforcement appropriations for public law doing states to even go on the fund mandate for public law doing crimes in states. So, long-term recommendation, we could explore passing the state version of the self-determination education assistance act. And if passed, the state people will come back with tribes and offer the maximum amount of program design, redesign, and financial flexibility for the various CPSOs needs rankings. So the recommendation is consider creating upper mobility for CPSO positions, either through compacting or state statutory changes or both. And consider providing funding for different levels of CPSO training. CPSO being equivalent to functional training being paid to a state trooper. And then finally, to work to define the same costs to providing fully operational public safety services throughout rural Alaska. But I'm really emphasizing that work to define the true cost of providing fully operational public safety services for Alaska. Right now, our CPSO grantees are great examples of local government delivering local public safety service in a significant partnership with the state. Only a fraction of that cost is actually represented in what the state pays through appropriation to the grantee organizations. There are significant indirect costs that the grantees pay and will get into that next slide. So, Madam Chair, there's nine recommendations, and at the level of yourself, Madam Chair, should I just go down right through the two questions or should I be moving? So, recommendation one, Madam Chair, is to update the CPSO statutes to provide a clear law enforcement and public safety vision and mission for the program, and allow CPSO personnel clear law enforcement duties and powers. Madam Chair, this recommendation comes because of how the program has evolved from a life safety program that emphasized search and rescue and emergency medical technician type functions and support. It did involve supervision of probation and parole through the corrections, support to corrections, but it has evolved to what it is today, which is the primary public safety response agency to everything from violent assaults, sexual assaults, homicides, journalists. They're all found on scene. Day, 2 days, sometimes 3 days before the trauma can get there, due to whether accessibility to the scene or other priority calls that AST is on. So, it, again, it's a version of the massive size of our state. We don't need to be reminded of the country in the United States on the world. And so, these DPSOs are the boots on the ground delivering public safety services in the communities where they're at. Our statutes do not clearly state that you have police powers, that you can arrest people, that you can enforce a criminal law. But yet, they were doing it every day in villages around Alaska because they had to. There were only people there to do it. And they have often done this at the cost to themselves and the community. So, you know, in state restaurants yesterday, two BPSOs have been killed in the line of duty. Delivering public safety functions, Thomas Maboli, Panaclinic, and Sir Roland Zimmerman. Roland Zimmerman and Sophie Eknick, those are bad calls. They're going on calls where people were armed with firearms and they were shot and killed. So I think looking at these officers and recognizing the clear role they provide in suppressing violence in the communities where they serve. This is a natural outfall of that. So we have to clearly put it down to what they are doing and what we need to train them to do. Recommendation two, Madam Chair, was to create more financial flexibility for the BPSO grantee organizations in the updated BPSO statutes. The financial flexibility deals with, and we'll touch on this in other recommendations, with the grants at times being very restrictive, and the language of what money was available for shot wires to your particular community, and also touch on equipment that the SOC needs to do the job, just like any other police officers or crew need to do the job. And if you touch on housing and things of that nature, interpretation of how the grant funds were distributed was very restrictive, and a lot of funding was left unspent because it was deemed to be not directly related to the mission spelled out in statute or beyond what the it was determined that they were allowed to do it in the role of an EPSO. So the bill creates a more financial flexibility, so we'll see a more full utilization of the funds we're all creating. With special area recommendation 3, which is restore funding levels to FY18 levels. We remember that $3 million was vetoed and out of the EPSO program. And largely, the reason for that is most of the money was unspent. That was the reason. Through these community meetings and meeting with the grantee organizations and all the partnerships involved, work group realized that the region funds were expanding just because there were so many denials of requests to utilize money in the policy commission. Thank you so much.
And so, do you have a question?
Thank you.
trying to verify, because I found that, like, that was the takeaway from some of your comments. Sorry, please continue.
Services and others need significantly more structural support to run a safe program. So the unfunded mandates do vary from Medicaid to Medicaid, and just remembering that the state is in such a great position to have these partnerships with local communities. But the community's desire is that the public safety should be delivered through local people, local government, public safety services. So, the argument could be, well, should the question come up, should we just have a trooper delivering all these services out of the state, absorb these costs, or the state to take this on? Saves the state untold millions of dollars, especially when we look at the retirement benefit system costs, much less all the indirect costs that the grantees are supporting. So, again, recognizing that appropriations may be easier, and that there is a finite money available, the recommendation for the unfunded mandates just says as much as possible within the appropriation. Legislature's fault, and now we never updated the VPSO statute to clearly show what the role is doing. And the troopers were like, well, that's really not your role. And the argument is not whether or not you're needing to do that. It's like, acting outside the scope of what the statute said. So there was kind of a mission collision on the dear things we desperately needed to do a big deal, but working outside of the statutory authority, doing personal attention to grants and asking honest questions like, are we authorized to fund these expenditures or not? And the bottom line is we had one public safety mission to put people with another, and it was the relationship really, I think, was harmed over time. And so the point of this is to not cast blame on where that would go other than we're sure to fix it. And it became clear that transparency was needed in managing these grants. Grantees did not have a sense of how much money was available to them, what would be appropriated, or why someone was authorized an expenditure and the grantee was denied. Congress has a much more transparent grants management process, including notifying legislators when unexpended block grant funds are in their area that they'd like to hear reappropriation made. For this type of purpose. And the fact that we would move the financial grant management piece to Congress is not in any way expecting grantees to help on voter DPS. It's just when it comes to managing the money, Congress is better than any. And I heard this directly from the leadership of DPS that managing grants for the piece of paper is going to be a very intensive for the troopers to do that.
I'd like to recognize the key representative Hannon for joining us on this one.
So I'm trying to bound up here now, right? It is also and I'm in here, so sorry, they will find me in.
Sure. So we like to
actually yes, now it appears to be working now.
Good, thank you. We had asked a question earlier. Representative Kopp was speaking to Recommendation 3 of the short-term recommendations, which is restoring DPS funding levels to FY18 levels. And there was a reference in the context of the presentation about the significant amount of money that appeared to be unspent in the DPS program annually. And I was just looking to verify if some of the contribution to that amount of money was related to a large number of funding denials that were made to VPSO grantees. And if you could begin by putting yourself on the record before answering that question.
Yes. My name is Michael Weaver from the Public Safety Coordinator for the Volusia Criminal Violence Association. I'd like to point out something else that we appear in a program like the Village Public Safety Officer Program. When the initial $3 million was taken from the program, mid-year, at the
those. You may not care, but what we realize in dealing with the grantees, remembering that all the grantees are functioning tribal governments that have formed these nonprofits to partner with the state to rely upon public safety. And one of their concerns was what significant training or experience requirements would be introduced without speaking with them first, because the group is a current group of men and women with significant experience in delivering public safety that are used to working together rhythmically, weekly, checking out each other, certainly monthly, and the whole group coming together to discuss regional needs and public safety. They do operate as a team. It's remarkable to see such a statewide collection of ideas from multiple organizations that are so connected to one another. Throughout this past year, it became clear that at times program changes could be introduced in a dramatic way that they thought they had no voice or no opportunity to respond to. So this is not just that program changes can be made, but that they would actually go to the grantees who do operate as a functional team and come together, and they're able to come together and sort of notice to go through with them and consult with them prior to making a significant training and experience requirement change. Because this gets back right back to recruitment and retention. Obviously, to recruit and retain people, you need to have predictability and stability in what you're advertising for the position and what happened to change for them. Finally, Madam Chair, recommendation 9 is to make their required revisions in place from the statute to operationalize the BPSO program and to facilitate the grant manager piece going to commerce. So, through high level overview, I'm sure we can take questions. I came in here, Mr. Schroeder is able to walk through the structural and I also want to put on the record the experience of our grantee public safety coordinators. It's significant. Mr. Nemeth, who just spoke, he's retired from the United States Army. Has significant professional leadership experience. We have retired state troopers who serve in leadership positions who are the grant coordinators. Many of our public safety director, Richard Hameroff, representing Lincoln's district, has been a public safety director for 2 decades of her life and has significant specialized training in managing public safety programs. We have tremendous men and women who have served a significant portion of their career in public safety and have the capacity to work together to solve these problems. Some of the criticisms were that these are nonprofits, you know, have the capacity to do this, which in the working group some seems not correct at all. They really have been doing well, and they just need to have the structural support given to them to do it.
Before we move on to the section of analysis, are there any questions from the committee members?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Excellent presentation. Seems like our members are ahead. I really appreciate that. We're just getting the recommendation. So I think the one thing I might add, just sort of as an addendum, is that the working group was structured initially to come back with several recommendations. And throughout the process of this meeting, we realized that it wasn't just going to be sort of one based on recommendations, that this was going to be an incremental process that was balanced before the committee. Certainly briefed a lot of them, but then we would continue to work on revising and revisiting, and hopefully with the working group being passed in the future, so that we could take sort of incremental steps towards restarting a program that, as the best pastor said, really is kind of languished over all those years.
Any other questions or comments?
Thank you.
structure can create staff for representative comp, and then we'll bring this through this as quickly as efficiently as we can. And I think I'll start by just saying this. As we're working on this bill, we were hoping to endorse the committee that because of the bank and line for personal legislation introduced, we did as well as we could to get the bill as close as it could be. But we still had a good line. And we think there are still more changes that need to be made in this legislation. And would love to be a substitute for that rather than maybe doing an amendment by amendment. So now I can draw a draw and I can kind of show you what some of the changes are. And these changes came from the grantee organizations themselves after the bill was introduced. Recommendations and things that just make them a little bit uncomfortable, I thought could be clearer. And so we're working with legal on that, but they're working on something called the budget up there too, so he's still running into a little bit of a long jam of work. So that'll work for us. So the other thing about the bill that the Representative Cobb mentioned is that the overall intent is before you is to try and create more financial flexibility for the grantee organizations and to give them as much also program flexibility, design and redesign and design, recognizing that each region is completely different from one another, and the best solutions, organizations with the best solutions for the problems that they face are the ones that are local. And I think the working group came to the conclusion that the organization just haven't been given that level of flexibility to create specific localized solutions for issues that may face in their own communities. So I'm just kicking right off in both sections. One and two, these really work together and they kind of speak to several of the recommendations that are supported here. Number one, I would say is recommendation number eight, the consultation process. This is a change that was made without consultation with any of the grantee organizations, and that is the background check requirement that was given in July awards. It's shifted basically at the discretion of the department as to who coordinates and who pays for the background checks. So this also supports recommendation number two, which is financial flexibility for the organizations. So sections number one and two just put into place the mechanism. Background checks will be done by the department from the BPSO program. Section 1 is a discretionary statute, that's the statewide statute, but any state program that requires a national background check, you'll find them in statute in section number 1. Section number 2 is the requirement that the Department of Public Safety will go ahead and authorize and pay for those background check recommendations. Starting on page 3, section 3, there's really a lot in here, and you'll see that the existing BPSO statute has been proposed to be repealed and reenacted, and then a lot of online recommendations are implying themselves as we walk through section 3 here, but specifically recommendation number 9, which was to take the existing regulations of the Department of Public Safety has for the program and use them as a starting point for the legislation, and that's what you'll see in our recording section number 3. And I really do want to highlight this because it's really also not here in recommendation number 1. This is in the report. We put this table in the report where we can try to compare the existing statute for the BPSO. And these are on the left. When you compare it to the state program department statute, there on the right, I can remember the first time I showed my wife in her part of the third game out, she got to this part and she said, well, what can BPOs actually do? I mean, if you look at the current statute for all of the required awards, there's one, two, three, four, five, six position phrase is before I get to that first bullet. The program, what they actually do is comparing it to the goodness of the state quicker. Right away, you have strong functions and very specific function functions and powers. And so this, if you will, the efficiency that you get to finish, you can take that one of two ways. You can be very flexible with how you manage the program, or you can be very restrictive with how you're going to manage the program. So I think at this point we're saying we need to create more specific law enforcement duties and functions for the DPC coordinators. And so here's what Section 3 looks like currently. The three bill that we enacted, statute, you can see, started with number one, some very specific law enforcement and life and safety functions and duties. One of the changes that we're currently working with legal is to something more specific on the trooper statute about the power of the third bullet there. Second and third bullet, power of a peace officer, power of usual customary exercise by peace officers. In case those are listed in the definition of statute in Title 1, right on the side, the state troopers have been listed as peace officers, but we think it would be important to mirror the state trooper statute as we kind of describe the powers and the functions of the DPSO officers, and that didn't make it into the draft that you have before you. So that's one of the changes that we're hoping to bring back in the committee substitute. Moving on then to page 4 of subsection B, mostly mirrors the existing subsection B of the current DPSO statute. The difference being that the reference to the Commissioner of Commerce and Economic Development is there, as well as pretty specific references in the federally recognized tribes. This is just kind of an acknowledgement that it's really our official creation that the grantee organizations are quote unquote nonprofits. So that's more just an effort to make the statute reflect reality. I don't speak for any of the organizations that will walk away from their nonprofit status, but we thought it would be important to at least acknowledge that it's actually the who we're actually really dealing with are fully recognized tribes. So that, I should clarify that that was really the purpose of inserting that with reference to fully recognized tribes. It wasn't to signal that we're expecting 229 tribes to apply for join this grant organization. Really the whole purpose of regulation of the mine and the statute to build up before you is to preserve the program as much of the status quo stays without completely upending it. This bill represents short-term recommendations that allow the program to continue to operate much as it has always operated, but hopefully with better funding mechanisms and more specific redesigned authority for the organization so they can actually deliver better public safety services to the regions. Moving on, subsection C comes from the existing DPS regulation 13AAC 96.20. And when you address the issue this way, I'll just walk through real quickly. Subsection D on page 5, line 9, is from the existing regulation, DPS regulation 13AAC 96.00. A couple of changes here. This speaks to removing unfunded mandates or funding unfunded mandates. The regulations specifically added an identification provision that required the grantee organizations to identify the state. I used to have to sign an agreement when I was the chief operating officer of Lincoln High School. I was not going to tell you backwards that we were performing a state public safety function and were being required to identify the state and send the state government for running their program. So at least to this building, I think we move that, we can get requirement from the regulations, consistent with the recommendations. Subsection E comes from existing regulations, 1380C-96.4, a little more valuable. We're still kind of looking at that and reviewing our regulations about this particular provision in the next version of the bill. Subsection F comes from 1380C-96.40, and that intention is we'd like to see this expanded to where you say it's so prescriptive that you get one ETSD officer per release, but that's that you would have the ability to, if the staffing mechanism for staffing ratios is one per one officer per release, we'd like to give specific flexibility for the organizations to assume that that is anything that they need to. Exactly, either become a two village or three village or move their officers around, and that's the same with the subsection I call G as well. Let's see, moving on to page 6, subsection I is nearly identical to existing provision. Subsection T of the existing statute, the provision says here on line 19, you can see that in exercising the rulemaking and the regulation about the authority we've put in, that will be a consultation with the ground recipients. And there's a specific subsection for them that spells that out. And line 23924 are highlighted because this is the only place in statute where the department, other than the commissioner's overall authority for public safety in the state, which the commissioner has broad authority under her legal authority, but regarding village public safety officers, this one line in the current statute is the only line that delineates the relationship that the department needs to be the state troopers have in interacting with the police officers. So in terms of the representative, talks about the internship. The way that they work together, we certainly have to kind of speak to the ways that they work together to deliver public safety. This is the only line in statute, so we wanted to preserve that as a way to signal, at least as the bill sponsor and the working group, that we expect those interactions to continue just as they always have. This goes with the desire for them to completely upend the program as the working group seeks to implement short-term recommendations for solutions to the program. So there you can see where that line exists in the current statute, and this is the kind of fallout of the current statute. Moving on, page 7, subsection K. This really is a brand new concept, and it goes with recommendation number 2, providing more flexibility. It's just a very specific instruction that the department gives. The language of federal was kind of contract language that I had negotiated in all kinds of agreements that the approvals won't be reasonably withheld. So the request for voting was what you need. They're not going to have that unless they flat out don't in any way come forward to the program. And the very last line on subsection K, we tried to make this as broad as possible that we're recipient of these funding for items reasonably related to public safety. And those public safety officer duties are in the whole suite of these statutes. So pretty much anything that's in the core members of this bill or public safety. The Department of Commerce is to approve requests for funding if it comes in. So, essentially, all here, and M are the consultation recommendations, and I would just say about these that these aren't going to be very familiar to the tribes because they don't really, if you recall in the presentation we did on the title recognition bill, there were several positives that looked like the orders and rules, but the executive branch of the federal government operated under. Are taken directly from those memos, and so they might be a little unfamiliar to the departments, but they're very section 4 on page 8, and we're coming in close here, Madam Chair, to the committee. As notes for the current BPS and officer qualifications regulations with a couple of changes, page 8.17 through 20.21, in the regulations, and this also will get to recruitment, that felonies were a lifetime ban. You can see, I'm qualified to be a BPS, so you can see on lines 16 through 20 that a lifetime ban was only a felony against a person. So other felonies with a 10-year prohibition on them, it's kind of recognizing that you might have done something in your 20s that you would never be able to do the rest of your life. You don't have to pay for that for the rest of your life if this is an occupation that you'd like to go into. And so we've added also the 920, just 10-year windows to some of these other misdemeanors like DV. And the same on page 9.4, you see controlled substances, 10-year window on that.
Madam Chair, I think this is really important to you. At this point, that we had a recurring immigration crisis in rural Alaska, and where the incidence of domestic violence per capita is very high. So, the question I will wrestle with is, do we need to accept a lifetime ban on people who have never had a misdemeanor? Never. Not a lifetime ban. What if your community leaders trust them and deem them qualified to do the job? How about if the village elders, the tribal councils, if they consider them rehabilitated, they consider that they have demonstrated good conduct, lack of community, lack of criminal behavior, show good community service, and consider their character to be sound? The bill says that you have no predictions within 10 years, and it was a non- felony crime against a person. So in other words, we didn't change anything in there. If you committed a felony against a person, it is still a lifetime ban. But a lot of felonies out there are drug possession felonies, or having alcohol, or, you know, practicing alcohol when you shouldn't have been. And a lot of these happen when people are young. So this doesn't say that you will be hired after 10 years and you have a loss. It just says that you're eligible to be considered. And that, this is about recovering the power and the trust to local governments, to local people, to local communities, so that people can reach their full potential and redeem their past and secure their future. I think that the heart of this bill is to allow villages and tribes to recognize their people who have been meaningfully pursued a new path forward and equip them to live out their responsibilities as productive, law-abiding citizens, not forever be denied a future because they didn't successfully come out of their past unscathed. Certainly, the idea of showing grace to another human being resonates deeply in the commitment we can all say ourselves. So I think what the working group is going to do is say that we are looking at areas of our city where the federal government is, we have a real public safety crisis, we have people in kind of very tough circumstances. But many of these people describe it as that has a mark are tested by the community, and this makes it so a lot no longer precludes people who have never had a misdemeanor domestic violence if 10 years or more have elapsed, or a non-felony crime against a person if 10 or more years have elapsed. It doesn't say they have to be hired, they must be hired, it just means they're eligible for consideration. But I just want to highlight, we worked with our grantees in this, and we feel it's, it will enable people to successfully move forward into a new future, serving the communities where they grew up in, who are willing to do this job and have the trust and very good numbers to do it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And right back to the community on audit, page 9.25, back on investigations. This comes right from DPS Regulation 13AEC 96.90. Moving on to the next page. The training requirements outlook just over some of this. And this also reflects a unilateral change that was made, as I understand it, the attorney with the attorney did this as well. But the thing to point out, our own test is 29, but the number of trained hours is 926. And right currently, the regulation is 96,100. MPA is 96,100. That balance figure is 240 hours. And that was a unilateral change made by the department. And at the request of maybe one or two of the grantee organizations, but not the majority of the organizations. Most of them favored the number of hours that you see, 826. 930, that's 650 hours, and that represents basically going to the group academy. So that's the minimum requirement to be a police officer in pretty much any municipality in this state or state troopers. So then the rest of the training just reflects really all of the functions that police men and women are currently doing, so it just recognizes the training that they have. So, I know I was writing the 29 program, one of our new police officers, they've been through the full academy, so they're fully trained up as a state trooper or police officer was in this region. The regulations now on page 12 would be BSNO officer certification, 104, 115, the Pinot orientation. These are all certified regulations. And we will just call out that highlighted on page 14 of the Bellson and the Transition Provisions. Section 5 just is the authority that Commerce needs to manage the grant. Section 6 is the grant voting provision for existing BPSO personnel who might be in training, but they wouldn't have the training that's in this bill, but have a different training for a different period of time when they were first hired. Section 7 is again specific instructions to the department that the current interactions that happen between the department and the state troopers will continue happening if this bill is to be passed. And we're asking that the grants management takes place July 1 of this year. The rest of the grant would take effect immediately. So.
I do have one question. Back to page 5.
That's a great question, Madam Chair. I think we probably need the department to really answer that question. I don't know that it's clear to the BPSO organizations. There's only three organizations that I can see that gets to any kind of staffing ratio, if it were. If you're an organization, you submit a budget with the number of positions that you request, you have to have budget that you would like to have a BPSO staffed in, and there's really no, at the moment, there's really nothing that instructs how many you get approved for based on how many you apply for.
So, Madam Chair, for the record, I have talked about House District 24. I'm sure the context of the entire bill is to create more flexibility so that recipients can use even a BPSO grant getting approved, tying that officer to a village that no longer would be denied.
related to whether it's to support another VPSO or go respond to an incident outside of Indian village, this language can be interpreted to allow that. In other words, you could get a grant tying a deep lease into villages to more than one village be doing the entire agreement on a VPSO. So I believe it is subject to interpretation. As Mr. Crane's alluded to, we could probably get better wording in there, but our intent, as we think the legislative effort, is that maximum flexibility for the deployment of the VPSOs be allowed within each partnership so that the grantee organizations that they represent regional areas can use their VPSO beyond just the specific village name in the grant, and it could be that we start naming villages in grants. So, our only has 10 villages served by VPSOs, and maybe every grant which is held and named in a partnership in that way, that would be able to do the VPSO that will be deployed where needed. And also, that's our common practices, and Mr. Muth could speak to this. There are VPSOs in South Philadelphia that have a drone target room. You could be interpreted as outside of the context, but that's of the grant. But our intent is that this new bill made it clear that VPSOs can be used in partnership where they are needed. And that's one reason why we wanted to make it clear in the law that they have commonly recognized peace officer power in statute so that wherever they are needed, by a grantee organization that is otherwise authorized in law to employ a VPSO, that they can go there and help out.
I'd like to just add that the contents are really important in this because it sounds like at the beginning of the presentation today, we identified where the spirit of the VPSO program was being held to the letter of the law, particularly within DPSC interpretation, and it sounded like there was a big values clash between the grantees that were operating the program on the ground and how it was being managed at the department level. And what I would hate to see happen is creating additional ambiguity that could potentially restrain the addition of staff in communities that are larger in size. So my district in particular, we have villages that may be around 300 people, but we also have villages that may be up to 700 or 1,000 people, which may require additional VPSO staffing. And so the intention behind my question is to make sure that we're not unintentionally limiting or restraining programs to just one individual per community.
Thank you, Mayor. For the record, staff charging of COP, and this is one of the sections that we're not having the plans currently constructed. And we did get a draft on the goal that was 90% where we wanted it yesterday, but we just didn't get it 100% in time to distribute it to the committee. So I'm hoping the next version that we present to you, you'll see language that is a little bit less troublesome than what is here. And this, if you will, I mentioned, comes straight from the current regulations. So this is the kind of expression of currently how the department is interpreting how to operate the program, start the program, but we're trying to come up with language for this specific division that is more flexible and clearly gives the grantee organizations the ability to move personnel around as they that's our goal of getting language will accomplish that.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative
Tarrico. Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess maybe just a simple explanation on page 5, line 4, it says a projected budget including administrative costs. Where it is, you look, and look at how I wrote this. We've just been given a within that administrative cost, do we include the capital purchases? Somebody moves forward with the budget, would that be included in the administrative costs, or do you think it would be a better explanation of that? So it'd be somewhat easier for everybody if it was a one application, one size fits all. I think a lot of the organizations certainly have a plan to know some of the things they'd like to do. And again, at this point in time, they actually apply separately to include that. Would this language be enough to include that as well, or should it be expanded to make sure that's clearly defined?
So, Secretary, an excellent question you raise. Our intent, as we understand, is to provide maximum flexibility because each region has different needs. So, one of the things about Department of Commerce that this change has is that we can make it fair enough in statute. One was authorized, they have the one size fits all, great application forms, here's what's permitted, here's what's outside the boundaries. It's very transparent, but it certainly is our intent that the every need identified in that budget application, now, if it's the legislature's intent, that no cap on what the city can hold in value, if a temporary modular holding cell, and there's actually companies that pull these out, where you can plug in electricity or hook up a fuel well here, and you have a temporary holding space. We had some bad fires in those holding spaces, which the community is aware of. And in response to that, there's providers now saying that we can do modular, holding cells. That's the capital. It's not even be my intent, but I think that's what your area needs, and that being allowed. So that Congress knows that that's an allowable expense. I think you raise a very good
point. Thank you. I think that's all the questions that we have really at this time. I want to be sure to get to our data testimony this morning, but before we do that, do you have any additional comments?
Madam Chair, we are greatly honored to present this to this committee, and also to introduce Steve, very honored to have Mr. Wilmot.
We will now turn our attention to an invited testimony from Bill Mayo, the Executive Director of the Tribal Government and Client Services at TNIT's campus, Executive Director of Alaska Tribal Unity, Co-Chair of the Alaska Federation of Natives, former Child Welfare Compact Chair, and the PSL Co-Director Compact Facilitator. Mr. Mayo, if you could please begin by introducing yourself on the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Will Miller, and I reside in Philippines. As the chairman of the National Tribal Caucus, the Great Day Caucus, in this little caucus, it's made up of all of the grantees of the PSO program. And these are the principal leaders. This group that they've been chairing just wants to express their support for the bill. We've been meeting intensively for about 2.5 years, including under the previous administration, trying to address the extension. We always get brought back to the same problem. The law is restrictive. And we were at times permitted to try things out that we did be brought back on a short lease because of the law. And things that we tried were working. And then we'd be aimed out. And it's not a spot on DPS that had to do with the law. But we were trying our best to advocate. So I'm also besides the chair for that grantee caucus, I'm also the chair executive director for the Alaska Tribal Unity Caucus. It's a statewide and a tribal advocacy organization. I also have submitted support documents, resolution,
citizen of the Neighborhood of Canada. He's a former corporation, he's a corporation CEO, also a tribal chief there. Days of a tribal chief often goes into public safety. Maybe also worked as the school janitor, but that was not paying job. Don't give up your day job. So that's what I would do, among other things. I was willing to firefighter in the village, also a volunteer search and rescue pilot for the community and surrounding communities. Pretty much dedicated to public safety and public service. As a community leader, I often had to pitch that as a law enforcement. I had been called into atmosphere situations in the early mornings, early hours in the morning, confronting burglaries in progress. Just kind of dealt with the issues that would come up when we did not have law enforcement. As the active shooter, I confronted them unarmed and talked to him to get me his rifle and his children, and I got this children to his grandmother and took possession of his rifle. These are the things that tribal leaders all over the state face. We don't have this happens all. These kind of things are common, all too common. And a lot of things have been said, and I just wanted to give you a little brief history. I've been involved with this program for about since its beginning. I remember the troopers were the only people who came out, and then we had what was called Crucibles, and then the Crucible program in 1980. And initially there was a lot of excitement. We managed to get a lot of local boys. There were a few women who hired on. These were Native members of the village. And this was the original intent of the law, because it makes sense. You have a local person, you also have, they can have their own home. You know, their own transportation, both ground and river transportation. And we have no need to find housing. Well, we soon burned out the local government where we put down in the 80s. We had about 17 officers, and almost all of them were Native members of those communities. And we had one or two outsiders who hired on, and we love them, and they're great. But we started to burn out the local folks, and we can't get them to hire on anymore. So we, the stresses of the job were just too great. They just couldn't continue. They were the only first responders in the community. The stresses of being of having long hours 24/7, knock on the door at any time, interrupting. Rest, having to confront friends and relatives, lacking loading sales equipment, and getting coal machines don't start, late night knocks at the door, and then societal pressures on spouses and children soon became too much, and we just did not seem to attract them as recruits very often. So, what happened was we began to drive it down the steps, right? But if you were a recruit, we would have to tell you that that posting that you have, we don't have housing, but I think there's a temporary place we can put you. You probably say you can bring those for your family. There's no running water or sewer, and somebody's going to donate a stove, locate a oil stove up for you. And there's no loading cell, there's no backup. These are the kinds of things we had to tell them. And so their pay was not competitive if they wanted to do it with the groups, police force, or the state troopers.
What do you do with these cards? And I'm going to
have to provide rovers who can move around. The GPS allowed us to do that for a while, and somebody realized that the law doesn't permit this. Well, we have to pay it. They said, you've got to have them in the village. We've got the villages with the city full, four of them. We've got 34 villages, sorry, 30 villages out there with nothing. And you know, so we, this law is, I mean, I would take this law and put it under my pillow so that I could sleep well. This law, there's that big of a difference. I wrote this law and I want to begin work with this. If we have flexibility in how we structure our program, we have flexibility in how we use our money, we've been doing it for decades, and we're doing it. We have zero findings in budgets of $200 million in 225 different programs. And we're good at what we do. We can do this. We need your help. We need this flexibility. We need this kind of meaningful legislation to provide for our people. And I just really support this. If you could start, there's some other cool stuff we could do. But now, I'm telling you what, the only problem with this bill right now is that it's just a bill. We need this in the law. And so I just wanted to tell you, I think by saying that this bill would work greatly to improve our public safety in our community. It's a good start. Basically, this key element that has made contact and such a glowing success for our tribes and tribal organizations all over the nation, but especially in Alaska. Public safety is a tremendous challenge in Alaska. We all know that. The tribal UPSO caucus has supported this solution unanimously. It does its permission for this work, the program, in ways that can improve services. So I just encourage you to adopt this law. And thank you so much to the working group, two houses across the party lines. This is stuff that for decades I could never imagine. It's amazing. So I just want to thank you.
Thank you. Concludes the items that we have on our agenda today. Our next meeting with the Tribal Affairs Committee will be Thursday, March 5th at 8 a.m. here in Brewster Hall 6. We will be having a second hearing on House Bill 287, including public testimony. The time is 9:33 a.m. in the hearing of the House Tribal Affairs Committee.